Thank you, Françoise. It's lovely to be in conversation with you, even though we are dealing with such a grave and difficult situation. We have known each other for many years and on different continents, so it's an honor to continue this conversation. Let me begin by saying that the censoring of the event at Cirque Électrique took the form of threatening to withdraw funds from that small artistic venue, a venue that serves the community. And so it was, yes, a cancellation, but actually a form of extortion. The funding for the arts and for cultural activities more generally is ideally a commitment to a free and open discussion of matters of public concern, matters about which people need to speak and to listen. We were about to have that discussion when the mayor's office acted as it did, contrary to the commons and the political ideals of open dialogue. It was quite deliberately an effort to shut down discussion of issues that very much need to be discussed and debated. And it took the form, after the fact of targeting Horia Boutelier, which was a form of public persecution against a well-known and much admired Muslim feminist that is completely unacceptable, a combination of both censorship and racism. And as I hope we will establish, an attack on anti and decolonial feminism. Secondly, and this is important, the mayor's office said that it feared for public safety and that the annihilation was a matter of public security. But where did that threat to public order or safety come from? It was, I believe, a threat made by ultra-Zionists who did not want to allow for a point of view that was critical of their own. So if this is true, we are left to infer that the mayor's office capitulated to right-wing Zionist threats. There is anti-Semitism, and not every objection to anti-Semitism is an instrumentalization of that charge. And we must combat anti-Semitism as we would combat every other kind of racism. I think it's important to remember only in the 1970s, beginning in the 1970s, anti-Zionism was identified as a form of anti-Semitism. Before the 1970s, you could have whatever view on Israel that you might have. And it was a political disagreement. But starting in the 1970s, there was a group of people who were representing the State of Israel, both in Israel and in the diaspora, who decided that anti-Zionism was a form of anti-Semitism. So it began there. It has not always been true. So there's a history to the charge of anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism comes to mean something new in 1970, and now it is almost as if anti-Zionism is the only form of anti-Semitism that anyone can name. So this is, in a way, a terrible history. Zionism has a history. In the late 19th century, through 1948, and even through 1967, to a smaller degree, there were anti-state Zionists, that is to say, Zionists who believed that it was important for the Jewish people to be revitalized, to have a spiritual life, to have a renewed cultural life. But they were against a state, and they were against territory. And in fact, there were fights among Zionists about whether or not it would destroy Jewish spiritual values to establish a state and a territory for the Jewish people. So there were anti-state Zionists, there were cultural Zionists, there were people who were Zionists who believed in a binational state, that is, a liberal democracy in 1948 that would be one state, binational, which would guarantee equal rights to all people regardless of religion, race, and background. And they were defeated in 1948. The binational Zionists. Now, all of these positions that I'm telling you are part of the history of Zionism are now called anti-Zionism. And they're now called anti-Zionism because the version of Zionism we are asked to accept is a radical, nationalist, racist state Zionism that insists on the demographic advantage of Jews and which has kept the Palestinian people in a state of dispossession, subjugation, and violent subordination for several decades. But I want to add, of course, that there is also a long history of Jewish anti-Zionism and indifference to Zionism. So many Jews do not identify with the Israeli state. They do not identify with Zionism. They may well have religious beliefs or practices or secular beliefs or cultural beliefs and practices that are specifically Jewish but have nothing to do with Zionism or are opposed to Zionism. And the most important of those traditions, in my view, is, of course, the Bundist tradition of radical socialist ideals of international solidarity, and these Jews have never been Zionist and will never be Zionist. When anti-Zionism is referred to by European governments like Germany or France, or by the mainstream media like the New York Times, it is understood to be a position that wants the destruction of the state of Israel. Okay, and this term, destruction, is extremely important. Because if, as an anti-Zionist, I say, I would like to see a different state formation. I would like to see a state with a real constitution that was the state of all the people. I would like to see a non-racist state. I would like to see a non-violent state. I would like to see a state that Palestinians are able to build either in a one-state or a two-state formation as they wish. If I say I want to see a state that embodies radical democratic principles and hope for all the peoples who live on that land, which would include the right to return, am I asking for a violent destruction? Or am I asking for a radical restructuring of the state so that it can, for the first time, be a democratic state? So destruction of the state of Israel is not the same as destruction of the Jewish people. No, the Jewish people will be much safer living on conditions of equality with all the inhabitants of the land. They will be much safer if they live equally with Palestinians, and Palestinians are given full freedom, equality, and justice. But these terms are instrumentalized, ça c'est le mot ici, oui, quels sont les mots qui sont instrumentalisés, destruction. You know, they say, oh, you're an anti-Zionist, you want the destruction. No, I want the dismantling of that state. I want to see a new form of government built, one that all the people helped to build. That is actually a nonviolent aspiration. The separation between Jewishness or Judaïté and Zionism is absolutely important. And we cannot allow for the appropriation of all of Jewish history and all of Jewish life by contemporary Zionist ideals. At the same time, when we look back at the initiatives that were made by Jewish thinkers in Brit Shalom or Ehud for a binational state against a state based on Jewish sovereignty. We see that even they did not recognize that this was a colonial state already, that colonization was continuing. No state can be built, no fair and just state can be built that does not first decolonize Palestine. But it is unfortunate that many of the most ideal binational movements did not have a sufficient critique of settler colonialism. And this was true of even, you know, of Martin Buber, of Magnus, and of all of them. They were still within the framework of settler colonialism. I accept that cohabitation can only exist on grounds of equality once decolonization has been complete. So for me, cohabitation is an ideal for the future for which we can only struggle through decolonization. Point to make here is that the Palestinian people need to decide on their own state. It is astonishing this morning in the New York Times, Biden does not have a plan, or Netanyahu does not have a plan for what to do with the Palestinians after the war. What makes them think that they have the right to make a plan for the Palestinians? And it's treated as if it's a managerial problem, like comment gérer les vies palestiniennes. No, c'est incroyable, à mon avis. But I think, really, this management of the Palestinians, what administrative authority? What is an administrative authority? An administrative authority is a colonial artifact that has been used in Africa, is used throughout the world by colonial states. So the state remains the state, and the administrative authority does the work of the state, right? Which is why so many people are angry with the Palestinian Authority for its complicity with the state of Israel. But Israel would continue that complicity. It's like, we need some more complicitous Palestinians in Gaza. Let's recruit people who agree to be complicitous to manage this. This is colonial logic. This is colonial logic. It is anti-democratic. It is a form of dispossession and disenfranchisement that has been taken for granted. So I really think it is not for the Jewish diaspora to say what form the state should take in Palestine. I will not do that. When the argument is made that the Jews suffered an absolutely horrific genocide, which is true, and therefore they are incapable of committing genocide, we have to ask, what is being said? What is the actual argument? It is because, having suffered the genocide, and my family also suffered that genocide, okay? Having suffered that genocide, they now have an identity which is based on the idea that they are only the victims of genocide, and as a victim of genocide, they cannot commit genocide. In fact, they claim that to be accused of committing genocide is obscene. Okay, but the fact is, Jews can suffer, Jews can cause suffering. You would think that this is a stupid remark. It is actually an astonishing remark. If you look at the Genocide Convention that was written mainly by Jewish jurists, genocide is defined as an attack against a group of people on the basis of their ethnicity, and also an attack on the infrastructures of life. Both qualifications for genocide have been met. In other words, it is not a highly debatable question whether the state of Israel is in the process of committing genocide and claiming that because the Jews have suffered genocide, they could not be committing it now. During or after the Second World War, as Jews, we are under an ethical obligation to oppose genocide wherever we see it. Who is qualified, who is eligible to claim self-defense, right? So, for instance, in the United States, the police claim self-defense when they attack black and brown people on the street or in their bedrooms or on the transportation vehicles. So some people are entitled to self-defense more easily than others. And it's also a question of who has the self, who has a self to be defended. So Palestinian self-defense is very often renamed as terrorism. And I think we have to expose this as a vicious way of demeaning their efforts to stay alive and to be free. I want to say two more things. For me, the State of Israel has justified its perpetual expansion, its appropriation of Palestinian lands, and its subjugation of the Palestinian people as self-defense. Only by subjugating the Palestinians will the Israelis be secure. So there is a discourse of security, a policy of security, which rationalizes the settler colonial expansion, the extension of military powers, the denial of basic freedoms and rights, and the continual dispossession of Palestinians from their land. And this is what we see now in Gaza as well. And at a certain point, one must ask, is it the case that the State of Israel will only feel free once they have gotten rid of all the Palestinians, once they have either permanently subjugated them under military control or pushed them off the land? In other words, self-defense becomes a term through which systematic oppression is justified. But also, here is, I think, an important point. When the subjugated people of Palestine rise up against the state powers, so many Israelis say, oh, look, you see, they hate the Jews. Do they hate the Jews, or are they fighting a colonial power? If it were a different colonial power, okay, let's imagine it's a different colonial power that is subjugating the Palestinians, and they rise up against that colonial power. Would they be hating those people for their religion or for their background, or would they be opposing colonial subjugation? But it is precisely because the colonial subjugation cannot be named within the colonial state that they continue to imagine that this is all another attack on the Jews. This is the same attack on the Jews. This is a Nazi attack on a Jew. And at the point at which a subjugated people, subjugated by state violence, is identified phantasmatically with the Nazis, right? Then we have erased all history, we have erased all operations of power, and we have denied the reality of a contemporary oppression through a commitment to a fantasy of Jewish suffering. A fantasy, a memory a phantasmatic regeneration of that memory for the purposes of defending the state and its violent operations. But I have to say something else. At the same time, the state of Israel says, we represent the Jewish people. No one else represents the Jewish people. If the Jewish people are to be safe and free, you must support the state of Israel. Okay. Now, as we know, this erases Jewish history, Jewish culture, Jewish anti-Zionism, pre-Zionism. Okay, it is a falsehood. But if the world is asked to accept the fact that the state of Israel represents the Jewish people, should we be surprised if many people think that the Jewish people are the state of Israel? We need to, this is why we need this separation between the Jewish people and the state of Israel, because otherwise the state of Israel will define what Jewishness is and what? Then we are in a trap. We are in a terrible, terrible trap. On the question of nonviolence, I would just add one thing. For me, nonviolence is not an absolute principle that you apply in every situation. Nonviolence is a way of imagining a future world. So even as we are in a war, in a bombardment, or we're involved in armed resistance or whatever our position might be, how do we imagine beyond the violence of our day? For me, nonviolence is aspirational. It is aspirational. What would it take? How would we restructure the world so that we could live together in a state of equality, freedom, and justice without violence? I want to hold open that question. I do not want us to forget that question. Okay, I would like to address first the question of what BDS is and what it does, and then secondly, the special case of Germany. In the last years, we have asked, in the last months, we have all asked ourselves, why isn't there more international pressure on the state of Israel to stop its genocidal actions? Who can put pressure? Biden? No, not at all. Uncritical allegiance to the state of Israel, following some idea he has from the 1970s. I have no idea. How? Through what form is international pressure put on the state of Israel to stop its occupation, to stop its genocidal actions? The most effective form of international pressure has been the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. It fills in where states fail, right? It is doing the work that international organizations, with the exception of the International Court of Justice, on va voir, and South Africa, thank you, South Africa. But most states and international organizations are helpless. They do not act. They do not pressure. They do not intervene. Who intervenes? Boycott, divestment, sanctions. And the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement has only grown over time. But also, one of the basic principles of the BDS movement, as it has been formulated by Palestinians themselves, is to target corporations and institutions that are complicit with the Israeli state, not individuals on the basis of their nationality. Let me repeat, not individuals on the basis of their nationality. So it is not against Israeli persons, people who have Israeli citizenship, 20% of whom are Palestinians, by the way, but against corporations, institutions, Israeli state-funded institutions that are complicit with the occupation. That is their stated goal. In Germany, it seems many people will say to me, you know, Germany has a long anti-Semitic history of boycotting Jewish businesses. and they are afraid of being associated with that long history of anti-Semitism. And that was an anti-Semitic history, and it was a hideous and deplorable anti-Semitic history. But the problem is to distinguish that history from the State of Israel, which, as we know, is not the same as the Jewish people, and it is extremely difficult for many Germans to do. But also, as you know, the modern post-war state of Germany has a raison d'état. It has a Staatsraison, which commits it to unconditional support for the State of Israel. So what distinguishes post-war Germans from their Nazi past? For many of them, it is the unconditional commitment to the State of Germany. Now, that means that they are not thinking, to the State of Israel. But that means they are not thinking, they are not judging, they are not making critical judgments. Where is fascism today? How might we oppose it? Where is genocide today? How should we oppose it? This is an uncritical allegiance and a moral panic, a fear of being associated with anti-Semitism that keeps them from acting on the basis of sound moral judgment and political commitment. But I do think there are more and more courageous people within the arts and courageous arts institutions that must stand up to this failed form of reasoning. About racism here, because it seems to me that anti-Semitism is a form, and sometimes the only form, that the German state can recognize. And unfortunately, anti-Semitism is linked to the criticism of Israel. So that is one problem. The second problem is that anti-migrant, anti-Muslim, anti-Arab racism in Germany is, of course, very well known, very well documented, very serious, but it is a terrible mistake if Germany uses its support for the State of Israel to further its racist attitudes and practices towards its own migrant community, its own Arab and North African communities. So I think we also have to remember that racism is operating in each and every one of these situations. I think we can have different views about Hamas as a political party. We can have different views about armed resistance. I think it is more honest and historically correct to say that the uprising of October 7th was an act of armed resistance. It is not a terrorist attack, and it's not an anti-Semitic attack. It was an attack against Israelis, and, you know, I did not like that attack. I have gone public with this. I have gotten in trouble for saying it was, for me, anguishing. It was anguishing. It was terrible. However, I would be very foolish if I then decided that the only violence in the scene was the violence done to Israeli people. The violence done to Palestinians has been happening for decades. This was an uprising that comes out, that comes from a state of subjugation and against a violent state apparatus. Okay. Let us be clear. Now, you can be for or against armed resistance, you can be for or against Hamas, but let us at least call it armed resistance, and then we can have a debate about whether we think it's right or whether they did the right thing, whether a different strategy. But the problem is, if you call it armed resistance, you are immediately thought to be in favor of armed resistance and in favor of that armed resistance and that tactic. It's like, well, actually, maybe not that tactic. And we can discuss armed resistance. You know, it is an open debate. But I think it is descriptively correct. If we decide that it was only or primarily anti-Semitic, again, we efface the political structure and the violent structure from which that uprising emerged. I will get in trouble for that, but you will defend me. You will defend me when I am attacked tomorrow. What is important to know is that feminism, queer mobilization, trans mobilization have to all be in solidarity with Palestine now, because we all suffer. We all suffer from forms of state and regulatory violence that makes our lives unlivable, or that makes us have to fight for our lives. I think we also have to recognize that Palestinian women and children are 70% of those killed and continue to suffer unspeakable harm by this war. Whether or not there is documentation for the claims made about the rape of Israeli women, okay, if there is documentation, then we deplore that. We absolutely deplore that. There is no question. But we want to see that documentation, and we want to know that it is right. Okay, there is no crime in insisting that we get that documentation. But to see Palestinian women on the streets outside Rafah, dismembered and killed. I mean, my God, why is that not a feminist issue? Why is that not a queer issue? We are all trying, I think, to oppose racist state violence, and that violence can be directed against trans people, against queer people. We see that state violence when femicide is not acknowledged or addressed by certain states, where they refuse to even recognize femicide as an extraordinarily common occurrence in this world. But we are also seeing femicide in Gaza. So let us not be fooled by the distinctions made by those who believe that feminism is on the side of the State of Israel, that engage in certain stereotypes of Palestinian men and boys as always somehow complicitous with violence. I think ending the violence, as the Palestinian Feminist Collective says, and I quote them, ending the violence is an issue of transnational feminist justice and solidarity.
Hey.